Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. It is April 30th, the last day in April. Yay, I guess. thank you, committee, for being here on time. There are two bills we will not be hearing. We will be hearing at 5 o'clock today, which would be Senate Bill 587 and Senate Bill 4, because amendments are not ready. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. There are two bills that we're going to send to rules, and that would be Senate Bill 31 and Senate Bill 948. So let me, so that people know what's happening, I'm going to open a public hearing or a work session on Senate Bill 948, and I'd like to explain what's happening. We received a fiscal of $500,000 for this bill, and we feel that we need to work it a little bit. I didn't want to have it go to Ways and Means to Die at this point in time, because I don't think the proponents would like that, so we're going to send it to rules. Lynn Marie, do you have a comment on that?
Lynn Marie Kreider, SEIU. If that's the chair's sense of the best way to move the bill, that's fine. I'm not sure whether we can entirely remove the fiscal. It will be balanced, of course, by fee income, but I know that doesn't prevent it from going to Ways and Means.
At this point, let's move it to rules, and then rules can move it to Ways and Means. So I'd like to entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill, 948 to the Rules Committee.
Is there any discussion?
Yes. Yeah, Madam Chair, in fact, committee staff has got, I have drafted two proposed amendments. For the record, I'd like the committee to have them, and we will continue that discussion in rules, but...
And describe what they are so that the committee knows.
Okay. Well, the first one basically creates a task force to look at the issue of certificate of need in a more global context, which is something that some committee members thought was appropriate. I also think that's appropriate. And the other one... the other one just makes some technical changes. Quite honestly, Madam Chair, the one that I prefer is the task force amendment.
And because they just came today, I think it's important for the proponents of the bill to be able to be aware of what the amendments are, look at them, and that's why I personally would like to move this bill to... rules. No, and I would rather have the amendments not put in, but at least they are available, and Senator Cruz would take them.
Madam Chair, I just wanted for the record to know they have been submitted and hopefully will be part of the discussion when the bill gets to the Rules Committee.
Madam Chair, I would just like to make this comment for the record to support the comment that you made. We're not sending this bill to Ways and Means to Die. We're sending the bill along to the Rules Committee so that the conversation can continue. This is a bill that still has legs and merits a lot more thoughtful conversation, and I support that.
Any further discussion on Senate Bill 948? Any opposition to sending it to rules? So ordered. So that takes care of 948. And now I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 31. Colleagues, this is the Healthy Kids Program, the Senate version that just has the policy in it. And as you know, the bill 2002, I believe it is, on the House side failed. It had the cigarette tax attached to it as a funding source. And so we want to keep this alive, and I'm sure the House is working on Plan B also. But I would entertain a motion to move this Senate Bill 31 to Rules.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 31 to the Committee on Rules.
Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. We are going to let... I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 159. And I wanted to let you know that I'm going to close this work session really quick. The proponents and opponents really couldn't come to terms on this. The agency did say that federal statute will preempt, and they feel that they will be able to implement what their goal was in this particular bill. So with that, I'm just going, unless there's any discussion on it, I'm going to close the work session on 159, and it is dead. All right. I'm going to, is this ready to go? Okay. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 519. Shannon, bring us up to date on this one.
Senate Bill 519 requires health insurers and the Department of Human Services through the State Medical Assistance Program to cover services performed using telemedicine. There's been a lot of discussion and several amendments on this bill, and you should have a dash 4 under the SMS in your packet. And this is the most recent amendment to come out. It just came out this morning, so probably most people have not seen it, but it is the work of the discussion that occurred on Friday.
I want to thank Senator Atkinson for convening a meeting in his office. We had Peace Health there. We had Joe Bell from the Oregon Telecommunications Association and Regents on the phone. And so the intent of the bill, we decided to keep it rural. We are not going to address telecommunications payments in the urban area at this point in time. Not. And so hopefully I would like to call Joe Bell and Regents up to see if they have had time to look at the dash fours. If not, we will move this to 5 o'clock if you feel that this is not appropriate.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I have had a real quick, for the record, I'm Joe Bell with the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. I have had an opportunity to look at it real quickly. It looks exactly like we talked about. The only question that I have, and I think it's pretty explanatory by someone who knows the insurance code, but section four on is not part of what we talked about, and I think it must refer to sections of the insurance code, placing it in those sections. I'm not quite sure, but other than that, we are fine with the bill.
What we could do, just to be clear, is maybe have LC come to explain this part of the bill. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Like Joe, I the main amendments to the bill look as fine as the discussion went, and we support those changes. I believe the insurance code definitions and application is necessary because of closed panel HMOs, and I believe there's federal law perhaps involved in that. I'm not positive. The rest of it makes sure that health service contractors, which technically are not defined as the same as an insurer, and Regents is a health service contractor, make sure that this applies to them. So I believe these are okay, but it would and for my part, if there's some fine-tuning that needs to be done, that can be done along the way, and it's not necessary to hold up the bill for that purpose.
Okay, I believe this bill, does it have a referral to Ways and Means?
I believe it does.
Yes, it does go to Ways and Means. If the committee...
No, it does not. No, we can send it.
I don't want it.
She coming back tonight? 5 o'clock. Is she coming back tonight? She want to bring it back tonight, or she can't?
You want to bring it back tonight?
I think that we really truly need to bring it back again tonight at 5 o'clock because LC is overwhelmed at this point in time, and to ask them to come, I think, is not going to work. So we will, that way it'll give you more time, and we'll talk with LC regarding the explanation of that. All right.
Thank
you very much. I will close the work session on... 587. Should we? Would you please call Dr.
Knight Richardson?
Knight Richardson, and let him know what we're doing, and that we may be calling him at 5 o'clock, and to get the correct number. Okay. Did I close that on 519? 519. All right. Did I say that already? Okay.
Did you say the right words about tonight? Did you say the right words to make sure we can take it into tonight?
I want to make sure that's what I was asking. She said I did, but I'm going to say we are taking Senate Bill 519 to our 5 o'clock meeting. And now I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 519. Okay. I'd like to open a... public hearing on SJM 8 because we have people here for that one, and I'm not sure anyone signed up, and if not, I'll go right into work session. Okay. Yes. Only if needed, John Christensen. Only if needed, Diane Lund, and the cosmetic associate, John Herson. So, John.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is John Herson. I'm executive vice president for the Cosmetic Toiletry and Fragrance Association in Washington, D.C. And we worked very closely with the staff on this, and have looked at the amendments and are very satisfied with the language. So we can be supportive of this resolution.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Are we referring to the dash two amendments?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
And would someone like to describe what the dash two amendments do?
For the record, John Christensen, staff for Senator Martha Carter. What the dash two do is essentially fine-tune the technicalities of it, bring it into the science that we know about these chemicals, and make specific recommendations to Congress that the community has sought.
I'm Diane Lund with Rachel's Friends. We brought this legislation to you, and we're very pleased that we have a consensus on this, and it sounds as if we're going to be victorious in alerting Congress, and I'm sure that Mr. Hurst and I will be meeting in the halls of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. someday soon. Thank you.
Any further discussion on SJM 8?
Senator, just for the record, I'd also like to commend Mr. James Markey, who represents the American Chemical Council, and he worked with us very well. We went over the memorial line by line, word by word. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Thank you very much, all of you, and for all of your good work. I'd like to close the public hearing on SJM 8, and I'd like to open a work session on SJM 8.
Madam Chair, I move SJM 8
Madam Chair,
I move the dash two to SJM 8.
Senator Gordley moves the dash two amendments to SJM 8. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move SJM 8 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves SJM 8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Carter, would you carry this bill? And I'll close the work session on SJM 8. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 756. Shannon, do you want to bring us up to date on this one?
Senate Bill 756 prohibits prepaid managed care health service organizations that contract with the Department of Human Services from excluding nurse practitioners from panels of service providers.
And if we could have the sheet on that. Okay. Liz Von Welsheim, Kathleen Chen, Rosalie Barrington. Gail Hand too. I mean, you can all. And Martin Taylor, who didn't sign up.
I didn't, and I'm sorry. For the record, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association, and I just wanted to introduce this group real quick. And first off, to tell you that this is an issue that has been on ONA's mind for many years. The marketplace since the creation of the Oregon Health Plan has solved much of the problem of excluding nurse practitioners from Medicaid panels, but I think that it is time to get the last of those outliers addressed. I appreciate your tolerance for this at the very last minute. It wasn't the bill that ONA brought to the legislature, but it is a bill that we wanted to adopt as a bit of an orphan because it was important. And I know that we told you we'd keep it short, so you let us know how many folks you want to hear from. And we've got written testimony from all these folks, and we will accommodate your time desires. Do you have a sense of how many folks you'd like to hear from?
Okay. I would love to get this done in 10 minutes. So please explain the bill and or why you feel it's necessary to have the bill.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. I'm Liz Von Welsheim. I'm a geriatric nurse practitioner. I've been practicing in Lane County for the last 20 years. I initially had my own practice up until about 10 years ago when managed care came into the healthcare scene, and specifically in Lane County, the Lane Independent Practice Association began overseeing most of the managed care products. At that time, I was excluded and have continued to be excluded from all of the managed care products as a primary care provider. 10 years ago, I left private practice and joined Peace Health Medical Group primarily because of this exclusion. I've since, in the last year, bought a care facility that takes care of Alzheimer's patients, and I'm allowed on the panels as only a specialist, not as a primary care. And I was almost excluded from the Trillium product, which is the Medicaid, Medicare dual eligible plan, to oversee most of the patients on my campus. There's 170 of them are Medicaid clients. I feel that it's time that LIPA and other organizations that exclude nurse practitioners just out of because of our title rather than our abilities or value to the healthcare field needs to stop. Thank you.
Hello, Honorable Chair Monis Anderson and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my patients. I believe this is an access to care issue. When panels remove my name from being able to care for them, I have a doctor of nursing practice as a nurse practitioner and dual certified as an adult and a family nurse practitioner for the last 15 years, currently with the internal medicine department at Peace Health Medical Group in Eugene. My experience coming to Eugene was that I was recruited as a primary care provider. In other words, I took over an internal medicine practice of a physician who left, and I inherited 1,500 members of her panel as my patients, only to find that many of them under the Lane Independent Practice Association, known as LIPA, were excluding me as their primary care provider. I come most recently from Southern Oregon, where I was involved with Midrogue Independent Practitioner Association, or called MIRIPA, and this operates out of Grants Pass and primarily Josephine County. A very high number of our patients in that area are Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, which is the retirement government services people. I found initially as an employee of the assistant medical director of MIRIPA that I was able to work as a primary care practitioner for the Medicaid, Medicare patients. I saw all of the practice Oregon Health Plan patients that were assigned to Dr. David Candelaria. When I left that practice to open my own company or my own clinic, I was met with resistance to being able to do that after 1 year of satisfying all the criteria of becoming and being a PCP as an employee. Suddenly, my 15 years of service, my background, opening and operating clinics in three states, Minneapolis, most recently coming from there with my own clinic where I brought medical students and medical residents in to teach in the clinical site. I was told as an NP I couldn't do that. When I presented evidence to the board that of my credentials and the number of patients who would not continue continuity of care with me, and there was a precedent of one nurse practitioner in the community who had been on their panel, they let me in. I'm finding that other colleagues in the area are scrutinized by no specific criteria as to why they should or shouldn't, yet every medical doctor just newly out of school is able to be on the panel initially. When I see the language of Senate Bill 756, which prevents the total exclusion without provocation of a very highly trained and effective healthcare provider on the team being encouraged to be a provider, that's why I'm back in this bill. I have found the access to care issue paramount in that there's confusion of patients when visiting consultants. I am listed as within Peace Health Medical Group, I am listed as the clinical PCP as well as the insurance PCP on everything except for the Oregon Health Plan patients. So when patients go see some consultants or going into the hospital, the emergency room, I'm often not notified that they've been there, and it takes a long time to track things down. My patients bring their family members in for me to take care of them, working with a model of holistic care for the entire family, and many of them don't understand why they can't choose me as a provider. Record keeping and written communication not only works against us, but it works in the delay of that patient getting care. Also, durable medical goods and pharmacy medical authorizations are often delayed up to 3 days because they don't get to the appropriate desk. John Latofsky, our newly appointed Chief of Medicine at Peace Health Medical Group, is endorsing this bill also, and I present a letter of his endorsement to the committee. And we have actually outlined that because of the policy within Peace Health, we can take 100 Oregon Health Plan patients per provider. And because of this restriction with LIPA right now, there are 800 patients not able to access Peace Health Medical Group because they won't allow the nurse practitioners to be a PCP. And as we expand our population of healthcare providers, we're anticipating hiring another 10 nurse practitioners, and that would account for another 1,000 patients that cannot access care to the nurse practitioner or to Peace Health, because we do have the maximum amount of people we can see in a certain amount of time. So it's definitely opening up an access of care. I'm not going to go into the any further depth about our credentials. For 15, 20 years now, we've have an Academy of Medicine of research studies showing our competence and how we can give safe, effective care. So having said that, I have presented everything in writing to you and am open to discuss this further with any of you as a group or individual. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. Thank you for allowing us time to testify on this crazy day for you. I'm Kat Chin. I'm a family nurse practitioner at Senior Health and Wellness Center. It's the only multidisciplinary geriatric clinic in the state of Oregon. It's with Peace Health Medical Group. I'm also the chair of Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 756, mirroring my colleagues' concerns, my own personal issues with the exclusion is, in our practice, Peace Health, until last year, made their rules for hiring nurse practitioners based on LIPA's rules. LIPA's rules say that nurse practitioners can't be primary care, so they're Board of Directors at Peace Health didn't allow until last year nurse practitioners as primary care. That changed when access issues became a huge problem. We can't hire enough physicians, and so that's why part of the reason why there are 10 nurse practitioner position openings in our medical group. Having nurse practitioners not be able to be on all the panels, particularly OHP panels, is very devastating to both the population and to access issues. And I think it could be easily, from my perspective, rectified, since we're all seeing the patients. We're just not seeing them under our specific name. Thank you very much.
I'll be very short because I did submit written testimony. I'm a nurse practitioner, adult nurse practitioner, trying to establish independent practice, and have had, obviously, the problems that have been already described. What I want to say is that I was supporting the original language. I think the amendment weakens it, but I am very happy with it because it'll be a first step. I do think it's a basic restraint of trade issue. AMA controls LIPA. The American Medical Association has motivation to have only medical doctors be primary care providers. However, there's law, there's evidence that we give good care to patients as primary care providers. And I encourage you to pass this out of committee and let it be further worked on and supported. Thank you. For access for the patients.
And I have a question as to who would be the opposition to this bill, because at this point we don't have
AMA.
No, it's the COHO. They don't have opposition to the bill as the proposed amendment to change the language to encourage to include nurse practitioners. With the language change, it's weaker than what we nurse practitioners would prefer, but it's not as strict as the original language. The original language, I think I would agree, is probably too strict. But we'd like to be able to work on the bill further if it does go out of committee, to be able to put in criteria that allows us to do grievance against an organization that says, no, you can't. And so at least we can start having an avenue. Right now there's no avenue. They just say no.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So how did we get to this amendment? Whose idea was it to put forth the amendment?
Senator Chair Miles Anderson, Senator Gorbley, members of the committee. For the record, again, it's Martin Taylor from the Oregon Nurses Association. We worked with representatives of COHO and Care Oregon to draft an amendment that would ensure that we wouldn't have opposition today, because we knew that you were on a fast track. the piece of the bill, the piece of the, what the amendment does is takes the bill from what we call an any willing provider clause, which says you can't exclude a nurse practitioner, which I think we agreed there are times or causes for excluding a nurse practitioner, to a standard that says simply that they're encouraged to utilize nurse practitioners, which, you know, we can all recognize is not very strong language. The piece that we weren't able to do in the time allowed was to come up with an appeal process, which we would like to add in the House, and I think CoHo and Care Oregon are willing to work with us on what that would look like. But that also requires working with the agency. There's some risk that an appeal will generate a fiscal. At this point, we don't have time to do all that. Even as the bill stands, it gives some legislative intent and direction to just a couple of outliers in our Medicaid providers. So we like it as it is, but we think that we can improve it in the House. And I know Emily Katz is in the room today. She was one of the folks we worked with at Care Oregon, so if you need to kind of get it blessed from someone representing the industry, I would recommend that you talk to her.
Well, Madam Chair, I will just say that I'm not happy with the amendment. I think the original bill is the desired course. This is, as one of the witnesses said, an access issue. Mm-hmm. And it is also an issue about inclusion of a group of healthcare professionals. So, you know, I would like to see language that is much more assertive, language that says that this will happen, shall happen, as opposed to this very weak language, which is about encouraging. That's not acceptable to me.
Yeah.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah. Well, to a degree, I agree with Senator Gordley, because it is that issue of access. I guess what Martin was talking about, I think we need to make sure they're not unintended consequences. And if all parties have agreed to continue work, you know, sending this bill on so it doesn't die, I think is important. And they can find what accommodations are appropriate in the House. And if it does, if we don't agree, we have conference committee to try to resolve issues.
Yeah, I would agree to sending it along. I just want to make sure it goes along with the strong statement that I'm making, that this weak language is unacceptable.
Thank you. I agree. I like the original bill better, but I have a concern taking this to the floor when we don't have CoHo and LIPA and those people able to give us their view. Mm-hmm. And so it's really the will of the committee. Either way, they're going to have to give their case over on the House side.
So are you wanting to move this along?
I want to move this bill along and
rules?
No, I want to move it to the floor. Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you very much on Senate Bill, 756. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 756, and we need to determine whether we include the amendment or not. Either way, they're probably going to be making changes on the House side. It's just...
I don't wish to move the amendment, Madam Chair.
And I can live with that.
Okay.
Leave the bill alone at this time.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 756 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 756 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And I notice that Senator Metzger is the carrier. He may...
For the record, again, it's Martin Taylor, Oregon Nurses Association, and Senator Metzger was very kind in introducing this bill, but it was originally an LC draft intended for Senator Morissette, who had asked for the bill. Just a little mix-up. So if I think Senator Morissette feels more ownership over this bill, would just be my personal...
Then we'll, thank you. We'll have Senator Morissette. And I'm a little uncomfortable without having a full flushing of the debate on this particular bill, but it's because it's the will committee, hopefully you will be sure to bring in those that might oppose on the House side to get it going, but it's very, very good. All right, with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 756, and I would like to open a work session again on Senate Bill 519 because we have LC here, Legislative Council. Lori Freeman, it would be very helpful for you to address that. Remind us, Shannon, of the bill and the questions that we had.
The telemedicine bill requires health insurers and DHS through state medical assistance program to cover services performed using telemedicine.
Lori, we had a question regarding the amendment, and we assumed that section four had to be included. Everyone thinks that it's okay, but we need to hear from you why all those numbers in section four.
Madam Chair, I think it was section four to the end of the bill. So.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel. And Senate Bill 519, the dash 4 amendments, the section 4 to the end, the reason it's in the amendment is because we forgot to put it in the original bill. But we have this sort of peculiar thing in Oregon statutes that if you want a new requirement for insurers to take effect, you have to not only put in the statute in Chapter 740. Where is this going?
Seven forty-three.
Then you also have to amend these two sections in 750, and one says. One applies to health care service contractors, and the other applies to multiple employer welfare arrangements. And as you can see, both of these statutes are just very long lists of all the statutes in the insurance code that are going to apply to these two types of organizations. So we just added this as the next one. And the reason why you have so many different versions of the same statutes is because we have uncodified versions that haven't yet gone into effect. And so when you amend the current one, you also have to amend the future ones that are going to, as they roll into effect. And we have at least one of these that has two note versions in addition to the current version. So there's a lot of language there, but it's really just adding it as a reference in those two statutes.
Okay. Now, I know that, thank you. Is there any other questions that we have for Lori? Thank you so very much, Lori. With this bill, remember, it is a mandate for commercial insurers. And I know that since we just got the amendments, and I don't see, I think Chris Schultz and John Powell were here. Do they want to comment, or have they seen the amendments?
Madam Chair, yeah. I thought John Powell already did.
Mike Becker did, yes. I mean, he was part of the workbook group. Mike, I'm sorry, I didn't even see you there. Okay.
Chairman, Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Yes, John Powell, I believe, already testified this morning that these amendments are satisfactory to us, and you are correct that we did participate in the discussion group last week that finalized these amendments.
Excellent. So it seems like
Senator Monson, members of the committee, Chris Schultz representing Peace Health. The amendments actually do not resolve our concern. The chair made a statement that the bill's intended to apply only to rural or underserved populations. We understand your concern about that. We'd like to reserve the opportunity to get back to you with more information about how we think it might cost less and not more, but understand the committee's direction. We support moving the bill forward today.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I just point out, if you look at Section 4 on, there's an indication here that our insurance code is probably incredibly complicated and probably more so than it has any reason to be. So, which points to we add things over time into statute, and it can become a relatively cobbled up mess at the end of the day. And I think all those references are certainly point to that. So,
okay.
That's not a comment against the bill. It's just a comment against the way we arrive at what we arrive at in ORS. But
We're in work session, and I think it's important for the committee to know that we need to take into account what Peace Health has said. They cited examples that you have someone who is across town seeing someone, and it would be so much cheaper in their eyes if they could do a video a telemedicine conference to a physician on the other side. And the way it's set up is that patient then would have to go across town to and then would be billed for another full service with the provider that he needed to see across town. But at this point, we're not sure what the fiscal impact is, and we figured that this is a good step to go forward just focusing on rural health. And this bill was supposed to, I'm not sure why we don't have a fiscal, because this will, I thought that it was supposed to go to Ways and Means, at least originally, due to the impact that it would have on Medicaid dollars. So, Shin, can you,
it didn't come that way from
Grant Higginson. Can you get up here and... this is a telehealth, and it was my understanding, and you may not have the answer to this because it should be probably OMAP, Jim, or I don't know if Joel would have any, or Jim Edge, maybe Jim Edge. One of you guys.
Madam Chair,
yes.
This is just a reminder that earlier we carried this bill over to a 5 p.m.
Yes,
hearing.
Yes,
just as a reminder,
yes,
that we did that.
But if we need to get a fiscal, it's important. It would be nice to have it before 5 p.m.
I agree.
Okay. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I apologize. We have not been tracking this bill at all, so I really cannot tell you anything about it. If you want us to look into a fiscal, we at the department will certainly do that and hopefully get it back to you by the end of the day.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear.
And Madam Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. We also have been watching this bill, but we put an indeterminate fiscal on it because of the fact that we just couldn't determine the scope of what was going to change based on the first version of the bill. Now that we've seen the final amendment, we'll try to get you a more exact fiscal and try to get that as quickly as possible.
Okay. And the amendment does limit it at this point in time to rural and not, and we'll see how we do with that. And then, but I'm sure that we'll be looking at Peace Health's concerns and address that issue once we figure out how this is going to work. All right. Thank you. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 519. And do we have this one ready to go?
We don't have a fiscal yet, but we have all the amendments and everything.
All right. Are we going to get a fiscal?
I requested that last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago.
All right, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 353. We're waiting for a fiscal on Senate Bill 353 also, and maybe there is not one. Shannon, remind us what this does.
Senate Bill 353 prohibits hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers from employing surgical technologists unless the surgical technologist meets certain requirements. Authorizes DHS to issue a waiver for facilities that demonstrate that they are unable to employ sufficient numbers of surgical technologists that meet the requirements. prohibits healthcare facilities from allowing surgical technologists to serve as circulating nurse and imposes civil penalties not to exceed $5,000 for violations by healthcare facilities.
Thank you. Dr. Higginson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson with the Department of Human Services, and actually we do have a fiscal on this bill, and so I'm not sure why that has not made it to you. For the first biennium would be $88,000 because there are some startup costs that are not seen after that, but then on an ongoing basis we believe it would be about $78,000 per biennium.
Thank you. Yes.
What would the public health be doing that would cost this dollars, Doctor?
Well, in the Chairman and Senator Carter, in the first biennium, we would have to be doing some rule changes and some adopting of new rules. Also, on an ongoing basis, it requires us to allow waivers for hospitals that cannot find enough certified surgical techs to allow them to have uncertified surgical techs, but they can only do that for a six-month period. And so we would have a routine of going through a waiver process and then every 6 months checking to see whether or not they're now complying or need additional waivers. There would also be a grandparenting provision so that other people could get into the program just from experience and it rather than certification. And so that's another piece of work. And then finally, we would be doing complaint investigations and possibly assessing of civil penalties on an ongoing basis for complaints when they came up. So it's not a huge amount of work, but we think it needs about a half-time FTE, and we simply could not do that otherwise. And we also think that somehow, because I'm assuming that this is going to be a fee-based program, that somehow we're going to have to get fees from surgical technicians, and so consequently we'll have to do something in the way of setting up a list that we'll be able to get those names, make sure that they pay on a yearly or biannual basis.
A question. Surgical technologists at this point in time don't have an organization that they belong to. Is that correct? Are you aware?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, as far as I know, they do not, but I would not necessarily be aware of that.
Okay. Yes.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, I'm Don Bischoff, legislative assistant to Senator Morissette. They do have a national organization and they have a state organization. And the what's envisioned in the bill is, I understand, there's more than one accrediting organization nationally, and it would be up to DHS to choose one to adopt the standards that would be the accrediting organization for the state of Oregon. We tried last session to do this by specifically naming an organization. Legislative Council informed us we couldn't do that. You can't name a private group in a state law like that. So it's left to DHS to make the choice through the administrative rules process. And it's our understanding that if there are costs to DHS in this, that they would be covered by the fees assessed. So there should be no fiscal impact on the state budget, on the general fund.
Okay, there is a process though that needs to develop for the oversight to be done by DHS.
Chairman Anderson, yes, they would be allowed. The amendment specifically says that they would be allowed to assess fees to cover. In fact, it says they shall assess fees to cover their costs.
And in order to do that, Dr. Higginson, you feel it'll be about $78,000 after the initial $88,000.
Madam Chair, that's correct. About $78,000 on an ongoing basis.
And we have a rule here that anything over $50,000 should go to Ways and Means.
That's correct.
And I know that's not the wishes of the proponents of the bill.
Chair Monis Anderson, no, it isn't. But we'll take it one step at a time.
All right. We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I believe we're moving three amendments: the -1s, 2s, and 3s.
Yes.
Would you like them all at once?
I think, do each one. Legally, let's do one by one.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 353.
Senator Gardley moves the dash ones. Senate Bill 353, any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 353.
Senator Gurley moves the dash twos to Senate Bill 353. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 353.
Senator Gurley moves dash three amendments to Senate Bill 353. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 353 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Gardley moves Senate Bill 353 as amended to Ways and Means. Any discussion? And was that with a due pass?
With a due pass recommendation?
With a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, I'm opposed to the bill, so I'll be voting no.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Peter Cordy?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Gardley?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Chairwoman Sanderson?
Aye. Motion passed. Thank you, committee, and thank you. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 353 and... I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 584. Shannon.
Senate Bill 584 creates a subtraction from federal taxable income for state income tax purposes for amounts paid or incurred by the taxpayer for participation in or coverage of health benefit plan for taxpayer or dependents.
All right. Who is...
What bill?
584.
I'm sorry, I was temporarily distracted.
By me?
By you, yes. Okay, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for the hearing on this. Colleagues, I would like to see this bill get sent to Revenue to be in the discussion. The essence of this bill basically is if we are truly trying to come up with ways to make health care more affordable, we ought to be using every avenue we have. Currently, businesses who provide health insurance for their employees can deduct that as an expense from their taxes. What this bill proposes to do is to say any individual who purchases insurance or an employee who has to pay for part of his coverage through his employer ought to have the same ability to deduct the cost of insurance from his taxes. In my view, it is a way to continue to keep people who may be on the verge of not being able to afford health care, give them a little more of an incentive to continue to carry it. It clearly needs to be a revenue discussion because I'm sure it will have an impact on revenue. So because it is a deduction, I would like it to go there. As a referral, allow me to have a conversation with Senator Deckert and get a study done on it by the LFO and see if it's something we can move forward with.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
It does have a subsequent referral, so...
I need to know if there's anyone else here to testify for 756. I mean, 584? No? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 584, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 595. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a small problem at this point because there's a dash one, which Monty King can speak to. The small problem was that he was assuming at this point it was the gut and stuff, which hopefully it does not need to be. But if I could, Madam Chair, I'll speak to the original bill. And the issue we're dealing with is that a company or an affiliate would provide stop-loss insurance if any employee's claims in 1 year rise above, let's see, am I reading the right thing here? Yeah. Rise above $50,000, but the premium would be understandably much lower. Many large companies practice this approach in provision of employee health benefits. They find in many cases that high monthly premiums go unused after employee deductibles and copays for an equal amount of medical services. For example, if 25 healthy employees in a given year do not use enough of the services equivalent to the premium, copay, and deductible, that may more than offset the expenses paid out for two other employees that year who have unusually high medical expenses. However, firms with less than an arbitrary 26 employees in Oregon are not permitted under our statute to self-insure with a stop-loss policy, even though they are financially capable. This bill would make a simple change to ORS 742.065 that eliminates the arbitrary threshold of 26 employees to permit those small businesses in Oregon who are able and wish to partially self-insure to do so. It does not infringe upon or eliminate other current health insurance choices like HSAs or HRAs. These provisions have been shared with the representative of Oregon's Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, who indicate no objection to this amendment. I ask for your support of this small change. It will help some small businesses that elect to self-insure health benefits in Oregon. And quite honestly, Madam Chair, not all small businesses would want to take advantage of this. This was a specific request that came to me from the Ford Family Foundation, who could benefit from it. And from their perspective, if they can lower their cost of insurance, that's that much more money they can put out in grants. So it's a small change, and I would urge us to take action on it. And Madam Chair, I'd let Monty King speak to the dash one, and if this bill has life, we could do the dash one as an amendment, or it would be up to the chair at this point in time, I suppose.
April McVeigh and Monty King, if you want to talk to the dash one amendments.
Good morning. For the record, I'm April McVeigh with Oregon Power Sports Association. Madam Chair, members, we are just simply asking for an addition to add in Section 1, Line 5, RV, motorcycle, ATV, and trailer dealers that were not originally covered under this bill originally.
I'm Chair Monty King, Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association, and also helps Oregon Power Sports Association. When the limited license law was instituted way back when, these types of dealers didn't have representation in the legislature and were left out of this section. So a RV dealer who also rents trailers could not sell the same insurance to somebody renting a trailer as they could somebody renting an RV. And the same is true for motorcycles, electric scooters, all these different kinds of things that are now being rented in the cities, in the rurals, in the, you know, on the beaches, wherever they are. These people can't rent and sell these people the insurance to cover the vehicles that they're renting. So it just allows these types of dealers to sell the insurance that everybody else can sell. So we think it was just a oversight when it was first passed. I have checked with the insurance. Some of the insurance representatives, they don't see any problem.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I was down in Florence when we were on the road, and Senator Gordon and I saw the dunes and all the young people on those dune buggies and parents not being able to have insurance. And seeing this bill just now reminds me that these families have no option, and that for people riding
motorized vehicles, it appeared to me that you need to be able to buy some kind of coverage for family members. So I will definitely support this legislation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Joel Ario.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, the Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I was here today to testify with some concerns about the original version of Senate Bill 595. I can also add some comments on the dash ones. Actually, let me give my testimony over here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a couple significant concerns with the original version of Senate Bill 595. It's about stop-loss insurance, which is something that's sold to people who self-insure, but self-insurance is not practical at the level of groups of 2 to 25. And so what you have really in a stop-loss policy in that market is something that could be called stop-loss, but is actually health insurance. And this gets complicated in insurance regulations, so I'll be very brief with it. But typically a stop-loss policy would pick up risk above a certain level, commonly like 120% of expected claim costs or something like that, and it would be sold to a very large employer. And if those kind of, for a large employer, a number like 120% of expected claims costs would mean that the stop-loss carrier is picking up a very small portion of the risk, because very rarely would an employer like that go over that kind of expected claims cost. Rule of large numbers, costs are pretty predictable. In a group of 2 to 25, if you sold that same policy, it would cost many, many times as much, because the policy would actually pick up a large part of the risk, because with that many employees, the costs go up and down quite a bit per year. So it's not a traditional stop-loss policy. It would be something that looked much more like health insurance, and from a financial perspective, it would not. It would be functioning as health insurance rather than stop-loss. So reason number one is it's just really not a situation where self-insurance is possible. Reason number two is the kind of policy then that comes into play there would be a way of evading the small group laws, the protection of the mandates, the protections of the rating laws, and the other kinds of consumer protections that we have. The legislature put the stop-loss prohibition in place there to prevent this from being a mechanism around all of the small group consumer protections that we have. So for that reason, we would have significant concerns with the original form of Senate Bill 595. I'd be happy to answer questions on that, and I can say something about the dash one.
Okay. So, Joel, what's the major difference between a business with 26 employees and one with 24?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, a business of 26 couldn't buy a stop-loss, a normal stop-loss policy on the market either. You'd have to be significantly larger than that to buy a traditional stop-loss policy, because as you correctly pointed out, it is a form of, it's like reinsurance. They call it, if you have underlying insurance, then the second level of insurance is called reinsurance. If you don't have any insurance to start with, if you're self-insured, then the second level is called stop-loss, and those policies are basically designed to take a reasonably small amount of the risk above some predictable level. At small levels, you wouldn't buy that kind of policy. What somebody would be selling you is essentially like a health insurance policy. I'll give you a simple illustration. You could say, I don't want to buy health insurance. I don't want to comply with the small group laws. I want to instead self-insure and buy stop loss, and I want to buy stop loss at $1,000. Attachment point, meaning that any expenses any employee has over $1,000 will pick up through the stop-loss policy. Well, that would look remarkably similar to a $1,000 deductible health insurance policy. And so if you allow that to be sold as and call it stop-loss, and when it's functioning just like a health insurance policy, essentially is a way around the small group market laws, and the kind of risk that you're taking on is really health insurance risk, not excess risk.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Well, if I could just one more. So what? Okay.
there is a difference between an employer with 24 employees and an employer with 26 under current law. I'm assuming that's correct. What is that difference?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, again, this was designed with the small group law, so it does, you're correct to say that it does cut off at 25, but in fact, if we looked at stop-loss policies above 25 in the 26 to 50 range, even maybe 75 or 100, I think they would turn out to be not stop-loss, not traditional stop-loss. We would say that those policies are probably health insurance too. And there's been a lot of, we haven't had this problem in Oregon because people have not been trying to market that sort of thing, but in a number of states there's been litigation around those issues of somebody calling a policy that is essentially a $1,000 deductible policy, saying it's not a $1,000 deductible health policy, it's a stop-loss policy that kicks in at $1,000. If somebody were to claim that's what they were doing, we would probably challenge that. I mean, I know we would challenge that here, too, even if it was above 25. It's simple to say we know nobody below 25 could actually buy a traditional stop-loss type insurance. So that's why it's in there. It's common among the states to have laws that just flat out prohibit stop-loss in that lower market segment.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess, Joel, if you're saying it's problematic for, let's say, up to 100 employees, so I guess my question at this point in time, to a degree, the 25 employee is somewhat arbitrary, and my question is, I guess I'm trying to figure out where the problem is, because if you have 26 employees, you do have the flexibility. Below 25, you don't. And if it's problematic at 26, as it would be at 24, why the arbitrary number? And I can't imagine that, you know, I have less than 25 employees most of the time. This isn't going to be something attractive to me, but I guess I'm wondering if there are unique and special organizations out there that this might be attractive to, why would we prohibit them from having access?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, again, I think you're making the best case that you can for a bill like this, because it's always, when you figure out where the small group laws cut off, you can always say, well, you cut it off at 25 or you cut it off at 50. What's the difference between 49 and 51? So at some level, I think you're correct to say that whatever number you pick, there's going to be, you know, arguments about why that's exactly where the line is and what about the people who are just under or just over. So that is an issue. I can't tell you that there's any absolute cutoff point, but I can tell you that at levels quite above 25, if someone were to sell something that was called stop-loss insurance but had kicked in at a very low level, that we would say that's not stop-loss insurance, and we would challenge. And we haven't even had that issue. I'm not sure we would have that issue here, because we have, I think, a pretty clean market. But as people look for ways to get out from underneath some of the bills that the legislature passes, that it does for consumer protection reasons, and they think they don't maybe need this or that consumer protection that the legislature says should be there, these are kinds of strategies that have been used in other places, and these laws were created to set some parameters and say, well, at least let's be clear that it can't happen below a certain level. At a higher level, we'd still probably have issues with a stop-loss policy that kicked in at very, I know we would, at very, but it would all depend on what level of risk the policy took. A traditional stop-loss policy takes a small amount of the risk on the top, then the person is genuinely self-insured. But if you look at how it functions, and the stop-loss policy is in essence taking most of the risk, and the person who's saying they're self-insured is really not keeping very much because the stop-loss kicks in at very low levels, that's not really stop-loss.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Dario, how can we help those small insurance people with stop-loss, or would you recommend that they just go to outright health insurance? Let's take the Dunes company, that, you know, the Dune buggies and that kind of stuff. How do we help that situation?
What would be your thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, excellent question. We have a bill that's coming back this afternoon, Senate Bill 587, which is our best attempt to improve the small group market, expand coverage within that market, and also give some more rating flexibility within that market, and make a number of other reforms that promote more employer contributions to policies, more employee participation in policies, and so forth. So there are a number of issues in that market. I think you're correct to recognize there are problems, and that is the focus of Senate Bill 587, which again will be back this afternoon. But stop-loss insurance, from our perspective, is not a viable option in this part of the market. We had a discussion in the House last week, and one of my former colleagues from the insurance division, now working for one of the companies, said back in his day that self-insurance was really not thought a viable thing at less than 1,000. Lies. It's moving down because of some of these more creative financial tools to back up self-insurance. But I don't know any reputable source that would suggest self-insurance is a viable option below, say, 250 lives at a kind of minimum.
Thanks. Okay. Speak to the Dash 1 amendments.
Madam Chair, we do not have a problem with the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that the limited license program we have for car rental agencies, where they sell that, you know, when you rent a car and they say you want a collision damage waiver and those coverages like that, we have a streamlined form of regulation for that, and the types of vehicles they're proposing to add here, which they read off to you. We don't have a problem with adding all-terrain vehicles and recreational vehicles and so forth. So with all due respect to Senator Cruz, we would be okay with the gut and stuff of the bill.
looking at the gut and stuff, does anyone else, do you have an opinion on that, Regents? On the gut and stuff, with, have you seen that amendment that
Madam Chair, just while they're coming to the table, one of the issues here, the related clause in this bill is very broad, relating to all insurance, but this is a property and casualty concept in a bill that was originally a health bill. So there may be other property and casualty stakeholders who have a concern here, but that's a different kind of insurance entirely that we're talking about.
Madam Chair, John Powell from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. That's correct. That's a property and casualty issue that deals with the limited license to sell insurance, as Mr. Ariel said, through like rental car agencies and things like that. Those people don't have to get a full insurance license to be able to do that.
And who is the property casualty insurance lobbyist?
Madam Chair, I do property and casualty with State
Farm.
Don does everything.
As far as I know, all right. We have no problem with that.
All right, thank you. I would have a problem. I think that the original bill would need work, and I would encourage Senator Cruz and the agency and other stakeholders to keep working on this concept and continue the dialogue. But I'm very comfortable with the gut and stuff. All right? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 595 and open a work session on Senate Bill 595.
Madam Chair, do you want to move the dash one?
I can't find the dash one.
It's just be on the very last page of it.
I shuffled it, so I'll find it. Okay, yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 595.
Senator Gordley moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 595. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 595 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 595 to the floor
amended.
With a due pass?
With a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, it's your bill. Not what you wanted. Would you carry it? Thank you. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 595. And colleagues, if you remember, Oregon Medical Association, along with Dr. Bates, had two bills talking about the hearing process, or the fair hearing process for physicians, and that was Senate Bill 925, and then also Senate Bill 924, which dealt with non-preferred providers and their coverage and co-payments and deductibles for services by non-preferred providers, and there were prior authorization and prohibiting health insurers from leasing or renting health insurers' provider panels to other insurers. And these were very complicated. We could not come up with consensus at this point in time, but we feel that it's very workable, and we're going to Senator Bates has agreed to working with OMA in during the interim to resolve some of these issues. So there will be either a task force or a group working together on Senate Bill 924 and 925. And we, believe it or not, only have three bills that we will be hearing at 5 o'clock.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
You know, in light of the fact that my one bill was stolen from me, it'd make me feel a whole lot better if you'd send the other one to revenue.
Well, I'm not comfortable at this point in doing that. We will be hearing 587, 519, and 4 at 5 o'clock. Hopefully the amendments will be, we have amendments to 587, and so have you gotten a copy, Joel? Let me just open a work session on Senate Bill 587 and talk about it a little bit. We are going to be hearing it. And staff will give the amendments, and it's very important for Doug Barber to get that, too. The underwriters are not pleased with the amendments, but they'll accept the fact and that there'll be a little bit more work done in the House, but we will be discussing that in depth this evening. So at this point in time, unless there's no further comments, I'm going to recess until 5 o'clock this evening. It is now evening, or early evening, 5 o'clock, after 5 o'clock. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 4, and Margie, do you want to bring us up to date, or should I? Okay, I will. Thank you, Margie, for being with us here today. Shannon couldn't be here, so she's hitting for her. We have before you the dash 10s, and Kristen, do you want to explain the dash 10s, and then I think we would like to call Dr. Halleck, and does Lori need to? No. Okay. All right. But first let's have, and I think you had some handouts you wanted to give us to help the committee understand, which I thought were so good.
Well, let's see. All right. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Kristen Leonard, representing the Oregon Center for Nursing. What we would like to do is go through the kind of a general picture of what the Dash 10 amendments will do. And what I have tried to do is create two flowcharts, if you will, so we can all wrap our minds around what I characterize as two of the more significant pieces of this legislation. So I'll wait for a moment to make sure everyone has the charts. Okay, the first I'd like to talk about is the overview of Section 6. And my apologies, my intention was to do this with a color printer so it would, the changes would be in red, but I didn't have one at my disposal this afternoon, so the changes are in yellow. And I tried to capture what Section 6 basically sets in motion as it relates to the Center for Nursing and other organizations dealing with the nursing and nursing faculty shortage. So Section 6 in the Dash 10 amendments basically allows the Oregon Center for Nursing, which is in the box kind of characterized as these are the organizations that make up the Center for Nursing, that will serve in an advisory role to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. So just as it relates to nursing shortage issues, this Center for Nursing and those members of that board will advise the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. The other piece that has been changed or added, if you will, in the Dash 10s allows other entities involved with nursing workforce development to also serve in this advisory capacity to the Workforce Investment Board. And so as we see it, it would allow groups like the Oregon Health Care Workforce Institute to also serve in that kind of an advisory capacity, because they deal with all different health professions, allied health professions, and so we see them as serving in that kind of an advisory role. But I figured Section 6 would make a lot more sense if we kind of had the map in front of us as to what the world would look like. Is there
any questions about this? And as you remember, the governor has the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and they're taking care of all of the workforce issues. And the center, Oregon Center for Nursing, basically we have had these nurses that participate in the Oregon Center for Nursing do a huge amount already for the workforce issues. And you'll recall that it was a subgroup that dealt with the curriculums, and now all universities and nursing programs use the same prerequisites and curriculum for training their nurses. So they've been very, very innovative and I think really cutting edge in the United States regarding getting nurses together to agree on common curriculum, common prerequisites. So they were already established. Now this is codifying them in statute, basically. And the members are pretty much the same of those that have been working together all along. The governor has taken on healthcare workforce issues also, and we didn't want to have there be a conflict. So that's why the Workforce Investment Board and those have been working with those who are proponents of Senate Bill 4 to try to bring some language that would be agreeable to everyone, so we were not duplicating. Are there questions regarding that? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not questions. I just want to make sure that this flowchart is on the record and speaks to legislative intent as far as other entities, to make sure that we're clear on that, because understanding the need here, the need in allied health professions is as great as well. So this flowchart as part of the record, I find very helpful.
It's also important to know that we have, it's not listed here, well, it is on your chart, Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. since that is a private entity, we can't really put that into, we didn't want, or else Legislative Council recommended that we not put that verbiage into statute. And so that's why, and will you go over that as part of the change in...
Carmona Sanderson, members of the committee. Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute is a public-private partnership, but I have to say that so is the Oregon Center for Nursing. Both are financed through private dollars right now. That's really the Center for Nursing right now is all private funding. So, and we tried to make sure that that was clarified in this language, or in the flow chart, so folks knew.
But I'm not understanding the statement that Legislative Council was hesitant to put Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute in statute. Did I hear that correctly?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Gordley, my understanding is Legislative Council has been... Concern might be too strong of a word, but they have questioned whether any of these entities you could necessarily put an expectation that they shall serve advisory by virtue of the fact that they are public, by virtue of the fact that they are private, they could at any point say, well, no, we won't serve in that advisory role. So that is their concern, is you shall do this, but by virtue of the fact that they are partially private entities.
And if you go to page 2, section 6, so how it was worded is the Oregon Center for Nursing, in partnership with other entities involved with nursing workforce development, instead of actually stating the Oregon State or the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, that would be included.
That really helps in the explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, since they're kind of equal as public-private, theoretically they both could have been included specifically in language. I mean, if LC is uncomfortable with one, they might as well be uncomfortable with two.
Mm-hmm.
But
this is the Oregon Center for Nursing bill, though. Yeah. All right, proceed.
Okay. I'd like to move to the other chart, and this basically gives a very general overview of sections 2, 3, 4, and 9. And there, we spent a lot of time the other day talking about these sections and the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee. And I know we're using the names of a lot of different organizations here, so this was my attempt to capture what this group would do. This group is currently in statute. And the goal of this committee is to adopt criteria and select grant recipients that are all working toward increasing the nursing workforce and the capacity of nursing education programs statewide. And so membership, there are 10 members to this committee. This currently stands in statute. And what I've done is I have highlighted those changes that we have made to what the current board makeup is. So kind of going down the list, nothing changed with the Oregon State Board of Nursing. They have 2 members. Oregon Council of Deans, this is the group that basically they have 1 member appointed that represents one of the nursing programs in the private colleges in Oregon. The Oregon Community College Association, so the dash 10s basically say the Oregon Community College Association puts forward the names of 2 members, but one of those members must be a nursing faculty member in one of their programs. Nothing has changed with the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives. They have 2 members. The Oregon Nurses Association has 2 members. And then OHSU has a member, and the change in the dash 10s says that one of those members must be a registered nurse and a member of member of the nursing school faculty at OHSU. So again, this was my attempt to make 5 pages of a bill look as simple as possible. But.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Does the committee have the letter from Lita Colligan, who's the workforce policy advisor?
Yes.
And I want that to be entered into the record also. And she had to be out of town today and wanted us to realize the governor has focused on improving the health care workforce since he launched his health care workforce initiative in 2003. And his main interest has been addressing the occupational shortages that will impact our ability to develop quality care. And he wants to remind us that the governor, through the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and you can look to your chart there, other local boards, and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development has already invested $2.5 million of federal funds in healthcare workforce initiatives over the past 4 years. And he lists what they were. And then he also has the Healthcare Workforce Initiative has actually recommended a package of investments to the governor for the 07-09 budget. And I think that's where the crux is. Everybody wants to make sure that, or the governor would like to be sure that his workforce initiative that's in the governor's budget be funded. And they're deeply concerned that that they are not included in the co-chair's budget. And so they some of them are like $2.2 million for a community college health care package for expanded prerequisites and distance learning, $7 million for OHSU Medical School satellite campus expansion, $1.4 million for the area health education centers at OHSU, funding and bonding authority for the OIT Center for Health Professions, and many community college health care related capital projects. So they're presenting this background to the committee so that we would understand the context of their support, which they say they are. They are supporting Senate Bill 4. Senate Bill 4 is about increasing Oregon's supply of nurse educators, but there's another piece of the package that the governor wanted us to remember. And with that, I'd like to ask Dr. Halleck to come forward. She wanted to say a few words about this issue also.
Hello, Chairman Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU, and I have with me Dean Sandra Tice, who is the Dean of Nursing at OHSU. So if you have any really hard questions, I'll direct them to Dean Tice. And also for the record, I'm a member of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute Board that we were just discussing. So I just wanted you to be aware of that as well. Our position on Senate Bill 4 is basically the same as that of the governor's office. We are very enthusiastic about the intent of the bill, the need for nurse educators, the need to recruit more students into nursing and retain them, and the need to retain people who are already nurse educators. So we're extremely supportive of all the intentions. And as the chairman knows, we were part of the original construction of Senate Bill 800 in 2003 that led to this. It really was the precursor of this construct. We also, however, do share the same concerns that the co-chair's budget as it currently stands, as we understand it, although it has some very good healthcare workforce initiatives in it, including our nursing initiatives, it does not have several other very critically needed healthcare workforce initiatives for OHSU. Those are the regional campuses and the AHEC program funding and a very small dental funding request. So we would support moving this bill forward to Ways and Means if that's the intent of the group, but with the hope that the governor's suite of healthcare initiatives would be funded, and then if resources were available, that the OCN and the other intentions of this bill would be funded. That would be our statement. The one thing that I would add to that is that for the past 3 years, the educational sectors and various partners that have made up the whole set of requests has worked very hard and with wonderful cooperation across OUS, the community colleges, and the governor's staff to put together a suite of packages that are extremely coordinated one with the other. So, of course, we're very supportive of those and hope the committee is understanding those other healthcare workforce packages as well.
Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Question? I think we have it all under control. All right. We're in work session. Is there anyone else that wanted to?
You ready? Madam Chair, I move the dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 4.
Senator Gordley moves the dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 4. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 4 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 4 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. It's on its way. With that, I'd like to close the work session to Senate Bill 4. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 519. And as you recall, 519 is Dr. Norwood Richardson, Knight Richardson's telemedicine bill. And we now have, we had a work group with Senator Atkinson, and we have the dash fours. Mm-hmm. And it looks like everyone is all right with that, but Joe Bell noted one little quirk in it, which really won't affect the bill, she says, but will you come forward and explain that to the committee? And Jim Edge, come on up, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to clarify this morning. I briefly testified, Joe Bell, Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. I'm a board member and the legs in the building, if you will. I testified this morning that it appeared that the Dash 4 had all of the components that we had talked about last Friday at our meeting, and I did verify that later in the day. The other thing that I was able to do was the Telehealth Alliance had passed HJR 4 in 2003, which is a resolution recommending that the state support telemedicine as reimbursing telemedicine services across the state. And one of the things that we did after that was work with a number of the insurers as well as OMAP, now it's DMAP, to develop a policy. And I was finally able to find that policy and rules. And the only thing I wanted to state for the record was some of the differences between, just for your information, because it doesn't impact our position on the bill, but some of the changes between these rules and the actual bill and the fact that they might have a fiscal impact. I mean, I think the one thing that that I just wanted to note is at the very top of the rules, it talks about real time, and we had put in person in, so I think that was that is a good clarification that we made to actually the bill. The pieces that I think would have an impact is in the bill under Section 2, and I don't have the exact references with me because I forgot to bring the bill up. It talks about those payment for the provider who's there with the patient and then the distance or the remote provider. And in the rules, it calls about the evaluating practitioner who's sort of the specialist. The bill would call, call for both of those individuals to be paid, and the rules actually only have the evaluating physician or the physician at the distance, the specialist, being paid. The other thing that is covered in the bill, the way it is written, that is different than the rules, is that the asynchronous store and forward telecommunications is not covered, and any telecommunications such as phone calls, emails between the practitioners, and that is also not specifically covered. And I just wanted that on there. Thought that would be information you might want for the record. And that's. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Also, I asked Mr. Edge to. I've always been concerned about the fiscal on this, and we haven't been able to get a fiscal. And so Mr. Edge is going to address that issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. As you requested, we had some staff work this afternoon to try to get our arms around some kind of an estimate of what the increased cost might be. We had put an indeterminate fiscal on this previously because it was just too difficult to know how this would be utilized, how much it would be utilized, and still the numbers I'm going to give you are going to be very rough estimates. It's not a formal fiscal at all, but we did look at what this bill might do and how it might be implemented. We looked at it especially as a tool to be used in rural areas, as you had requested. We looked at a small savings probably in the transportation program of DMAP as a result of some less miles traveled. We looked at the cost of a transmission fee for telemedicine and assumed it might be the same as the Medicare transmission fee, which I understand is about $20. We looked at some increased utilization because of the possibility of paying providers both on the sending end and receiving end of a telemedicine visit. We looked at some small increase in utilization, and staff came up with, a very rough estimate of about a 2% increase in the cost in the areas where it would be implemented. And in the Oregon Health Plan, for those areas we're talking about, that would translate to about a $6 million total fund per biennium cost, or about a $2.5 million general fund cost. And again, I put the caveat on there that it's very rough. It's only a rough estimate.
You said
2.5 million general fund and about $6 million approximately. And that's plus or minus quite a bit. it's just a rough estimate.
Questions? All right. There's no further.
I do have a question. The information that we're getting now about the fiscal is all verbal, and it's also based on assumptions, and you've made that very clear. When might we get something in writing?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think we need to know a little bit more about exactly how this would be implemented before we could get a more formal fiscal. Right now, we're making a lot of assumptions about, especially about the rural versus urban that was discussed this morning. The bill actually, I don't think, addresses rural versus urban, but we talked about it verbally this morning. I think we need a little more clarification about how it would be implemented before we could get very much in the way of a firm number. This also is just addressing the cost of the Oregon Health to the Oregon Health Plan. It's not addressing private sector commercial carriers, and I think that would need to be looked at also.
I don't recall in any of the testimony hearing rural versus urban. We did hear rural and underserved communities. So again, just with an eye toward trying to understand the information that you're presenting now, and again, your short version of the assumptions that you use to pack all this together. Madam Chair, is it your intent to want to send this along to
Ways and Means? But I think I had addressed the urban versus the rural issues because Peace Health wanted to change, had an amendment that would
actually include them, and they didn't feel that the bill as written now would include them, and they were citing their hospital and clinics located in the Eugene-Springfield area where they actually wanted to use telemedicine in that capacity, and we felt that we truly wanted to focus on the rural at this point in time. So the intent is to address the rural issues, but knowing that the urban or the peace health issues will be addressed at a later date. And so so that's what we want to make sure goes down to Ways and Means.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would think it's going to Ways and Means, so be time for the full LFO investigation. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You ready for a motion, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash for amendments to Senate Bill 519.
Senator Gorley moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 519. Is there any discussion? Any oppositions? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 519 as amended to Ways and Means.
Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 519 as amended to Ways and Means.
With a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, Senator
yes.
Gorley, I could support this if we didn't have a due pass recommendation, because I don't think it's in the governor's budget. Is it in the governor's budget? I could support it if it wasn't a due pass from the committee.
Okay. I'm willing to withdraw that and make it move to Ways and Means, Senate Bill 519 as amended. Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 519 as amended to the full Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 519 and open a work session on Senate Bill 587. And let's call Joe Ario and Ed Niebert up. And as you recall, this is the underwriter's bill, and we could have passed it off very easily, but Joe Ario and his group complicated the issue a little bit because they have an amendment that they would like to put into this bill. And I want people to know that the underwriters have agreed to this amendment, the dash sevens. Knowing that it could be stripped in the House if it was going to be bogged down. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, Chair and Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Let me start by giving my sense of appreciation to the underwriters, because they did have a fairly simple bill here, and the amendments we're going to describe tonight include all of what they wanted to accomplish, but considerably more as well. And we very much appreciate their willingness to work with us on this matter. What I'll do is just speak to the substance of the bill here. It is a comprehensive, we think, set of reforms for our small group market, really the first set of major reforms in that market since the 1995 session, when we set in place the current rules and regulations for small groups. At that time, it was a 2 to 25 market that most of the rate regulation applied to. Some of the other rules applied more broadly. And the first point on the bulleted list there is probably the most important, that today this proposal, the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 587, will expand that market from 2 to 25 to 2 to 50. That is in line with what most states do. I think there are less than 10 states that have only the 2 to 25 market, so we're in line with what most states have done. We believe it will bring more stability to the small group market. In the 2 to 25 sector, it's dominated by groups that are very small in the 2 to 10 range, and this will bring in a larger set of groups and bring more stability to that market. And then, of course, will help the groups in the 26 to 50 market that would otherwise, that market today is not regulated in terms of rates, and so this would help the groups in that market who would otherwise be subject to higher rates because they had either older or less healthy workers. There are then, of course, some people today who are younger and more healthy who will have some amount of rate increase. This is always a winners and losers type of situation, but we have a phase-in procedure to address that.
So and you will be monitoring that, so if there is adverse...
If there are, Madam Chair, if there were adverse developments in the market, yes, that's the idea that we would monitor that as we went along. So that's point one on the bill. The second point is that we would expand the rate band in that market from its current 2.5 to 1 to 3 to 1. So that gives a little more rate flexibility in that market. We think that is in line with market dynamics these days, and that to give the carriers more flexibility in how they rate groups within this larger market makes sense. And I note there that the current rate band is 2.5 to 1. If no bill passed in this session, then the current 2.5 would sunset and we would be back to a 2-to-1 rate band. So we've looked at, you know, where the winners and losers are, and we think that the rate band of 3-to-1 is the appropriate place to go.
Yes.
Is there a sunset on the 3-to-1, or is it just in place?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, no, it's just in place. There is
okay.
no sunset on
okay.
this.
Okay, well, I know when we went to 2.5, we put a sunset to measure it.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we are hoping with this bill that it sets the market in a stable way for more than just a couple sessions. The third point about the bill is what factors can you use within the rate band? And this was a very important issue and probably was a lot of our discussion among the us as regulators, the insurers, and the consumer representatives. The current rate band allows only age to be used as the rating factor within the rate band, which puts a lot of stress on age. If you have a group of 60-year-olds, you're right away right at the top of the rate band. If you have a group of 20-year-olds, you're right away right at the bottom. We now have a number of factors that in many cases will offset each other, and they also promote better, broader coverages in the market. So instead of, under current law, you can take account of just the age of the employees. It's a broader and fairer principle to take account of the age of all of the enrollees, the employees, and the dependents. That has the added advantage of encouraging dependent care, because most of the time the dependents are younger, certainly if they're children, and so the more dependent care there is, that will bring down the average age, so it's an incentive to have more dependent coverage as well. Employer contribution rate, that should read, that's a typo. So that also encourages employers to contribute more to the health plans. Employee participation rates, more employees that participate, that can be considered a rating factor, so that encourages broader participation. We do in this bill allow the carriers to rate based on tobacco use. We, of course, know that tobacco use is correlated with
question.
Health.
So if an employer contributes more, does that usually, where does that put it on?
Madam Chair, that would generally be a favorable rating factor. So the more the employer contributed, because that will mean that more likely more employees will participate, and the carriers generally, if a group has 25 people in it and 23 of them are participating, that looks better to the carrier than if you got a group of 25 with only 10 participating. So again, on tobacco use, that can be used as a rating factor. And then participation in wellness programs, that can be used. You've heard in a lot of different contexts in the discussions about health care that promoting wellness is an important factor in the market. It's certainly something that is very aggressively used now in the large group market, and we think it appropriate to bring that into the small group market as well. And what we're talking about here is participation in wellness programs. So you get credit and better rates if you can have more of your employees take a wellness questionnaire, do certain activities that are on a wellness program. It's not based on outcomes, it's based on participating in things that would help you help your employees become more healthy risks. And then finally, group longevity with the carrier. If you stick with the same carrier for a longer period of time, that can be a rating factor in your favor. That is common in a lot of other lines of insurance. We all know, probably most of us know, in our auto insurance, the longer you stay with one carrier, you get longevity credits in general there. This would encourage the same thing in health care. And, of course, it's a minor step here, but it does help align incentives better if a carrier is holding on to risk for a longer period of time, then some of the investments in long-term health become more sensible because they're going to keep the business. If the business turns over every year, some of the preventive stuff doesn't have the payoff to this carrier, might have payoff for another carrier. So all of that, we think, A, creates more flexibility, takes some of the stress off age, and also just gives more flexibility in the marketplace. Bullet number four on that list, we spent quite a bit of time at the end discussing this one. The carriers were certainly interested in being able to use claims experience, claims status as a rating factor, and we finally settled on a limited use of that factor, limited to plus or minus 5%. And another important point about this, in addition to it being limited in that way, is that it comes in after the group is placed on the rate band. So you start with all those other factors in three to one rate band, you place a group on the rate band, and then you can add the credit plus or minus 5%. So it functions more like a credit or a surcharge than it does as an out straight out rating factor. For groups in the 2 to 25 market, where this would be a new factor, we say that the 5% has to be done within the rate band. For the larger groups, which have had more broad use of claims experience in the past, and this is a compression of that, we say that the 5% can take you outside the rate band, either on the low end or the high end. But of course, that 5%, it would only affect groups that are placed near the top or near the bottom, in terms of going outside the rate band. Point number five, we allow different classes of employees. This basically preserves the current law, which is that in the 2 to 25 market today, an employer can choose to have different classes of employees, a management class and another kind of class, say, in a restaurant or something, but they have to cover all classes. That stays the rule in that market. In the 26 to 50 market today, there can also be multiple classes, and the employer doesn't necessarily have to cover every class. So we preserve that kind of flexibility. Because.
And what is a class? What do you mean?
Management employees is a common type of class. Ed may have better examples than I do on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's actually defined.
And introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan, and I was the designated liaison to the discussion and negotiation group representing health insurers with the department and coming to this consensus bill. Madam Chair, it is defined in the amendments to the bill that classifications have to be based on bona fide business classifications such as salaried, hourly, full-time, part-time, can have nothing to do with health status.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, But similar to, I mean, is it in any way similar to the, like, workers' comp classes, or is it entirely different from that?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I do not believe, I've never seen it used in the health insurance industry, that it would be similar to workers' comp classes, which are risk-based of exposure to work-related risk. I think, in fact, that would be prohibited because these amendments say that such classes cannot be based on health status. They have to be based on what I would call employment status. And the most common, again, would be management, non-management, full-time, part-time.
So if you had two groups of workers that would be in different classes for workers' comp based on the risk of the job, you wouldn't be able to make that distinction here.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, that's correct, I believe, as Ed said. It's actually almost the opposite of that, which is if the categories have to do with risk status, then they're prohibited. So the idea here is not to separate your workforce into the ones most likely to be healthy and the ones most likely not to be. That's prohibited. It has to be based on broader business classifications than that.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, where is that language in the bill? Really?
That language is on pages 10 and 11 in the bill. And again, this is preserving current law.
It's good stuff.
It's The it starts on page 10, line 26 is the small employer for 25. It says, you know, if you offer coverage to a small employer with no more than 25, the small employer carrier shall offer coverage to all eligible employees without regard to the actual. Well, that's like the classification is above that.
Mm-hmm.
That talks about the categories must be based on verified employment-based classifications that are consistent with the business employer's usual business practice. And then A requires, if there are classes under 25 in sub A, they all have to be covered in the health plan. And B allows in a group of 26 to 50 that you might cover one class and not others. And we had a lot of discussion of that. The reason for that is the current market condition. And so we didn't want to have a situation where groups today that can cover some of their workers but not all of their workers would be required to make a choice between either getting everybody covered or dropping coverage for the ones that were currently covered. So we, on that issue, left the status quo.
I'm still looking for the language that's in current law that defines the classes in the way that you described.
That is in 6, sub 6, where the current language, and the current language, again, would apply just to group small employer. The current law means groups of 2 to 25.
Yes,
so it says that a carrier may provide health plans, different health plans of different categories of employees, when the employer, the small employer, has chosen to establish different categories in a manner that does not relate to the actual or expected health status of such employees or their dependents. So that's the current language.
Okay.
And then we added the second sentence to give more emphasis to that point that the categories must be based on bona fide employment-based classifications.
All right, I'm following you.
That would be point 5 on the list. Point 6 is that we streamline the rules here for how employees are counted and a number of other simplifications, because now instead of having a market of 2 to 25 with rate regulation based on Oregon laws and a second market of 26 to 50 that is a small employer market under federal law, it doesn't have rate regulation, but it is subject to a number of different regulations. So we've had a lot of issues between what applies to the small 2 to 25 market, what applies to 26 to 50. And but for a couple exceptions, like the one I just did, we're basically melding those markets together in one uniform set of rules, and the counting has gotten a lot simpler. And Ed, having worked the details of this, is an expert on how he can explain to you how the counting issues work. But we basically created more flexibility there and gave employers more choices than they had previously. Point number 7 on the list is to phase in these changes over 3 years. I mentioned that before, that it would start on 1/1/08, and it would be done by rules that we developed to ensure that everybody was phasing it in a more or less consistent way, and that we minimize disruption in the market. Finally, point 8 is on this list, but as we've discussed that right up until today, that's been the issue that has still been in controversy, whether there should be language in the bill that would say that DCBS can take into account profitability and investment earnings. And the carriers have said, well, if that language is in the bill, then we want some qualifiers on it. We've been going back and forth on it. And finally, the proposal we bring to you tonight is to delete that language, and I need to put this on the record, though, that we do today consider profitability investment income. We have very broad language in the rate review area, and we clearly take it into account. On the one end, we have to take it into account with a group that's in financial difficulty. We cannot ignore the fact that a group that an insurer has been unprofitable, and so we sometimes, it's not very pleasant to do, but sometimes have to basically require carriers to take a rate increase in order to deal with a difficult financial situation. And we have always done it on the other end too. When a carrier is overly profitable, that is a factor that weighs into the process, and so we do take it into account. What we were trying to do in the bill is make that explicit in the statutes and make the health, life, and health statutes look a little more like the property and casualty statutes with more detail in them. But as we've gotten into it, we start talking about, well, then we want some qualification on it, and we thought it better to simply put on the record that that is what happens and that we don't, insofar as we have broad authority now, we don't need to have this issue specifically addressed.
So it's not in the bill?
So yeah, the version you have in front of you, the dash sevens, do not have any profitability language. There's other versions you have in front of you if you wanted to go to them that do have profitability language.
No, let's forget it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, though, so that's my summary, and I think Ed may have some words to add, or maybe hear him and then take questions. I can take questions on too.
Any questions? Great. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the.
Is there anyone? Oh, did you want to speak to the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Very briefly, I wouldn't have been offended had I not, but I do want
to.
First of all, want to thank Joel for providing what I think was a clear and accurate summary of both the intent of the bill as well as the operation of the bill. I want to address, before I might forget it, Joel's last point about the deletion, let me call it, of the language about profitability and investment earnings. As Joel expressed it, that authority is already implicit in the review that the department does. The insurers have no problem with that implicit authority. We were a little nervous to make it explicit in a way that sort of seemed like health insurance was suddenly being picked on in that way. So we're very happy to continue the status quo on that. I would only add a couple of context notes here. Again, I was the sort of designated representative for health insurers in discussing this with the department. I think they drew straws, and I wasn't there that day. And I want to point out that this is a significant change in the marketplace. The rate-regulated small employer marketplace today is about 193,000 covered employees. That's a big chunk of folks. We would be melding into that market another 70,000 employees in this mid-market group of 26 to 50. So that's a significant change. Our major concern as insurers in this was not, oh, let's oppose the melding of these markets. Gee, we make more money in one market than another, and let's not rock the boat. That was not our concern. Our concern was, let's do this in a stable, healthy way, and by stable, I mean a way that encourages everybody who is covered today to stay covered and not drop out because they got hit by some unintended consequence, and to encourage more into coverage, because the more into coverage, the more stable the pool will be and the lower the average price will be. When your best risks start dropping out of coverage because they think the rules work against them, the cost goes up for everybody. So our whole purpose in negotiating some of these details was to try to stabilize this and keep the pool where it is and to grow, we hope. And I think some of the things that Joel mentioned we think are especially important. The slight expansion of the rate band from 2.5 to 3, and that's a compromise between the rate band today for the smallest groups and the lack of a rate band for the mid-sized groups. So we said, let's meet in the middle to try to stabilize this market. The addition of the rating factors, the addition of this limited cushion recognition of health experience, we think will also stabilize the rates. It doesn't kick anybody out of coverage. It doesn't gouge anybody on their rates, but it refines their rate, we think, in a way that will stabilize the market. And then the 3-year transition period to make this happen in an orderly fashion. So we're satisfied with what I would now call these consensus amendments represented by the department and the industry, and we hope you'll find them acceptable.
Thank you. Doug Barber, your bill.
Right. For the record, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. The outline.
Remind us what the original bill is.
Well, what the outline that Joel presented to you, points 2 and 3 are really what the original bill was. I mean, it expands the rate bands to 3-1, and it increases these rating factors that can be used, but it's only in the original bill, it's only in that small group market, that 2-25 market. And that's what the insurance agents, that's where they saw the problems. They think this flexibility will be very important. It will strengthen that market, and they're very strongly supportive of that. There is not unanimity among the agents about what happens when you bring in the 26 to 50 market. From their perspective, that market's working well now. And so, you know, they still support the bill that they introduced, for the record. But they also recognize that, the components of what they want are in, the -7 amendments that the industry and the insurance division are bringing forward.
Okay. I'd like a motion on the floor.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 587.
Senator Gordley moves the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 587. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 587 as amended to
the floor.
The Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 587 to, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz, you want to carry it?
Okay.
Thank you. I'll close the work session of Senate Bill 587. And we are going back to our 8:30 times on Wednesday. With that, we're adjourned.